The names and the stories in this episode have been omitted to protect the privacy of the individuals involved. This is Jocko Podcast number 37 with Echo Charles and me, Jocko Willink. Good evening, Echo.
Good evening.
And with us tonight, I am honored to have retired Chief Warrant Officer Roger Hayden here with us tonight as a guest. Now, unless you are in the SEAL teams or you were in the SEAL teams, then you likely don't know who Roger Hayden is. In fact, I'm going to go ahead and guarantee you don't know who Roger Hayden is. There's no book. There's no movie. There's no social media. There's no one to Google. And I've talked before about how there's three types of guys in the SEAL teams. The guys that built the reputation that the SEAL teams has, the guys that maintain the reputation of the SEAL teams, and then there's the guys that live off the reputation of the SEAL teams. And usually those guys didn't contribute much to it in the first place. But let there be no doubt, Roger Hayden is without question, one of the people, one of the men responsible for building the reputation of the SEAL teams. He did the massive heavy lifting and laid down the foundation of everything that the SEAL teams are in the jungles of Vietnam. And he passed on lessons of combat written in blood that we carry to this day. One of the guys here, Roger Hayden, that truly forged the attitude that makes the SEAL teams what the SEAL teams are. And I'm going to tell you quickly how I first heard of Roger. So I was a new guy at SEAL Team 1, so it's 1991. And back then, SEALs weren't that popular yet, and the old SEAL, UDT SEAL reunions were not that big of a deal. They were just kind of a small little gig down at like the Lions Club or something in National City, real low key. But the only guys, none of the younger SEALs went to them. It was all Vietnam SEALs, maybe a couple World War II guys. And I was down there, I was with my running mate at the time, my good friend who's at SEAL Team 1, who I had gone through buds with, a guy by the name of Chris. And we were just sitting around talking to some old Vietnam guys, and we were getting pretty fired up. You know, it's kind of, there's, you know, once you pay the $10 fee to get into this gig, there's free beer. So we were a few beers deep, you might say, and we're listening to stories. And again, we were new guys. This is 1991. Never been in combat. So we were there to try and learn and about the history and learn about the guys. And finally, me being young and dumb and pretty well buzzed, I asked these two Vietnam guys that we were sitting there talking to. I said, hey, who was the most badass murdering motherfucker and SEAL in Vietnam? And both these guys looked at me and said, Roger Hayden. And I remembered that name. And when I actually met you for the first time, I'd met you a couple times, but then when I actually worked with you for the first time, you were a lane grader on a platoon full mission profile. And that's actually the first time I learned, truly understood the concept of cover and move, which is a basic tactic, which guys didn't know. No one had taught it to me. This was my second platoon. I'd already been through a workup. I had the idea in my head, but hearing you say it, the way you described it, I said it clicked in my head and I never forgot it. And I actually wrote about it in the book, Extreme Ownership. And it's what I taught to all the SEALs that when I was putting through training, that's what I taught them. One of those fundamental tactics. And so that's kind of my introduction to Roger Hayden. So Roger, I know you've actually literally never done an interview before, and I want to thank you for coming on. It's a true honor to have you on the podcast. So welcome.
Yeah, Roger Hayden here. Thanks, Jocko. Really appreciate it. And you're one of my heroes, too. Different environment, different times that you kicked ass and took names, too. the I was just one of the boys in the in SEAL Team 1 when I got there and deployed a couple of times with them. And our environment was the jungle, and we got pretty good at it and went out and hunted the bad guys. Nobody else in Vietnam, as far as I know, Army, Marines, or any of them would go out at night. They would usually hold up in a base camp or somewhere like that while we figured night times when they move around, that's when we're going to move around and see if we can find these guys and take them out. And that's what we did. It isn't one guy. It's a team effort. Everybody works hard. I had some great, great buddies of mine that were, I mean, my gun partner was a stoner guy, and I was a 60 guy. Between the two of us, he shot 1,000 rounds a minute, nine, a 5.5, I mean, a 7.62, my 60. It worked out well. Last platoon I was in, we carried 4.60s and 5 stoners.
Good
and
Lord.
If you didn't carry a stoner or a 60, you carried a 16 with a 203 on it. Or XM-148, but for back in the day, guys.
Say those numbers again of how many guys were carrying 60s and stoners?
Four of us were carrying 60s, and five guys carried stoners out of a 14-man platoon. Yeah. That's what we operated.
So for those of you civilians out there that are listening, that's a lot of firepower.
Yeah.
That's a way you bring the thunder. And so where'd you grow up, though? Before you got in the teams, where'd you grow up?
Basically, my roots and what I look at, my dad was a carpenter, so we moved quite a bit around, but it was a place called Ronan, Montana, by the Flathead Lake in Montana, where you have the Mission Range and a real, real brief area. I grew up green breaking horses and stuff like that and building tree houses and just working on my grandpa's farm and my uncle's ranch and stuff like that. So that's kind of where I grew up at. I lived a while in Phoenix, Arizona and stuff like that. And says here in the next thing, sports. So I played football, outside linebacker. I boxed for 2 years in high school and I swam. My dad worked on the tram in Palm Springs. And when he was there, I went to Palm Springs High School. So I got on the water polo team there.
So that's how you got a little comfortable in the water.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And so at what point, what year was it when you actually decided you were going to join the Navy?
It was 1965.
And did you already know about the SEAL teams? Well, no.
Nope. Nobody knew about them. My dad, like you said, he was a carpenter, but he was in UDT-3 and... It was at swam on the Incheon Harbor in Vietnam, but I didn't. I'm not Vietnam, Korea, but I didn't know anything about it because he never talked about it.
So your dad was a frogman.
Yeah, but I mean, I knew guys that knew him, older guys. Right. I mean, when I was a young guy, like you said, you were when you're talking to, you know. So anyway, but he never said much about it. But when I was a kid, you know, I watched the Bridge of the River Kwai and the Guns of Navarone, and I also seen the Marines hitting beaches and the Rangers getting wiped out. And I went, okay, if you're going to fight, you want to get in something that you think you're going to come back with. So that's why I became a frogman. And we didn't go through BUDS. It was UDTRA, underwater demolition training. So,
you joined the Navy. Did you go straight to underwater demolition training?
No. Back in the day, they wanted you to have an A school.
Okay.
So I got out of boot camp in 65, went to North Island in Coronado for about 7 months waiting for my radioman school and was lucky enough to go to 22 weeks of radioman school and then went from there to USS Paul Revere for about 4 months and then went to training. And I started training January 6, 1967.
And how big was your class when you showed up to that?
There was about, I don't know, 200 of us maybe 150.
How many guys made it?
There were about 30 of us that made it, which was pretty good, and it was colder than shit. But I don't know how you guys did when you went through training, Jocko, but we made a pact that we weren't going to let anybody quit, and we did everything we could to make that happen. So, and some guys did make it through that we shouldn't have.
That's one of the things I've talked about with Leif is you see that. And I was never instructor at BUDS, but eventually you say, you know, you don't want to help people through.
Yeah.
If they're not going to make it through on their own, you don't want them. You know, that you got to get guys that are going to get through it on their own.
Yeah, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, I know.
We got close and just figured, you know, screw this, you know.
I had a guy that was a previous fleet guy, and he had been to BUDS before, and I became friends. He was a second class mature guy. And I thought, yeah, this guy, I'm going to kind of follow his lead a little bit, you know? Second night of Hell Week, he quit. I was laughing. I'm like, Mike, here's a mature guy, 27 years old. You know, I was a kid and he's quitting. Ridiculous. So then when you got done with the initial UDTRA, you went to, you checked into UDT, right?
Yeah, UDT 12. It's really funny because me and a good friend of mine up in Flagstaff, where I joined in, we decided we're going to be Marines, you know. So, and his dad, Guadalcanal, you name it. His uncle's DIs, he's a Marine, but he talked me into it too. So we went up to join the Marines. Well, that office was closed, and right across the hallway was the Navy recruiter, and there was a boatswain mate of the line, you know, leaned against the door, and he goes, "What are you boys doing?" "Oh, we're going to join Marines, you know," and which, you know, it's all good.
Yeah.
And he goes, asked the other guy, "Well, what's your parents' background, everything?" "Marines, Marines, Marines." So he knew what he was going to. He said, "How about you?" "Well, my dad was in the Navy, a chief," and da-da-da. He says, "Come here, son." So my buddy went off to be a Marine. I went in the Navy. That close.
Yeah. I think we all have a story like that.
I know, really close though.
Yeah. I had a buddy, Bruce. We saw like some ship pulled in and we saw guys in Marine uniforms and we were like, "Let's go join. Let's just go join." That's how effective that recruiting tool is.
Oh yeah.
It's luckily I held luckily a little longer.
It wasn't open, you know, but the Marine or the Navy office is open. So recruiting office.
And so you showed up at UDT. And then what was the schedule there? I mean, the Vietnam War was already on, so now it's like, is it 1966 now?
No, I didn't. Went into UDT 67. I graduated from training Cinco de Mayo in 1967, and that's when I went over to UDT 12. Yeah, the war had been on. And then we had heard a little bit about SEAL Team, but it still didn't. Nobody knew much about it because everybody I graduated with, East Coast and West Coast, you went to a UDT team first. Then you did a trip with UDT. Then you came back and got in the SEAL Team.
And how was that? How was that first trip with UDT?
Oh, it was great. I did a 9-month trip, and we had different debts that you went to in Vietnam. Like first thing we did is go to Da Nang, a place called Camp Tin Shan. We worked up at Phu Bai, Wei, Quang Tri, Dung Ha, all over the northern part of South Vietnam. Doing demo work, different things, you know what I mean. And then we left that debt and went on the USS Dyshenko, and we did about 110 miles of beach recons.
Ooh.
And then from there, we went. Some of us went down to a debt in the.
Were those hydrographic reconstructs, or were you looking at the beach?
They were perpendicular.
Old school, yeah, perpendicular.
Parallel. Not perpendicular, but most of them were parallel. We didn't do any perpendiculars at your combat op, you know what I mean? But
So for those of you that don't know, the original job of one of the original jobs of the UDT was to find out how deep the water is off of a beach. So
and obstacles and
if there's any obstacles there that could trip up a boat that's coming in. And so you said you did 110 miles of
3 months.
That's and so you have to swim with a lead line. So you have a cord with a piece of lead on the bottom of it, and you've got different markings on it to tell you how long it is. And you sit there and you swim along and
every 25 meters, and you have a beach party on the beach and it has a swimmer line going out, and we had it hooked to an IBS in case we got hit or something, that IBS could turn and get us out of there. We all grab onto the, of course it was only a 9.5 horsepower engine, so you didn't go out very fast if you had
it. You'd be able to swim faster.
But every 25 meters you'd take soundings when you got back to the Dyshenko, then the cartographer, which I was lucky enough to be one, you drew up a hydrographic chart.
Right.
When I got to UDT 12, you know, you're pretty regimented, and I'll call it buds. It was UDTRA, but you're pretty regimented buds. When we got there, our platoons weren't even formed up, and you were kind of lost at sea, you know? I mean, nobody's really telling you what you have to do. You're not in a platoon yet, and it was kind of floating, you know what I mean? Went up and did lifeguard stuff for the Marines when they did landings up by Pendleton and stuff like that. It wasn't really a lot to do. You know, we're going, Jesus, you know, played volleyball a lot and stuff, you know, ran around your UDTs and coral boots and, you know. So then we started forming up, and how UDT worked is that they'd be home for 9 months. and then the whole team would deploy and relieve the team that was out there, like we relieved UDT 11, and 11 would come back. 9 months later, they would come out and relieve us. So it was 9 month deployments in almost port and starboard. You didn't have like a year and a half, 2 years of workup. It was about 9 months.
9 months home, yeah, with a workup. And there was the workup. What did you do during the workup?
Oh, we did everything. We did recons. We did demolition raids. We did river recons. We just...
How many guys were in a UDT platoon?
18 or 20. Maybe, yeah, might have been 20. It was quite a bit because you got the swimmer line, beach party, and all that other stuff. You know what I mean?
That's why we did the old ARC platoons. We always tried to get a couple extra guys because, yeah, we needed them to cover more beach.
Same deal. Yep. Yeah. And everything you did on, and we'd do it was just a lot. You know what I mean? And it was a lot of physical work, too. You know what I mean? Everything. UDT, actually, when we went through training, I think we did about 50 times more swimming than the guys doing buds now, because, mm-hmm, that's what we were. We were frogmen, mm-hmm, you know, so.
And that's a lot of, if you're doing more swimming than we did in buds, that's, yeah, a lot of swimming. I'm glad I went through buds instead of that.
Well, the surf out there in January is pretty cold.
Yeah, there's no doubt. Yeah. Andy, when you were there, you were telling me before about some of the, kind of hooking on to some of the conventional units on some of their operations that they did with the, I think it was the 9th Infantry.
Yeah, so we were down in the Delta, and we were doing river recons, and I think we're the only ones that ever did it with this. They called them the darts, and it would look like a jet ski, but you laid on it, and you guided it with your feet. It had a 355-degree camera up on top and a fathometer on the bottom of it. And it had a piece of aluminum like this, of course, so you wouldn't get hit with the props and stuff. And the handles were on the right and left. You know what I'm saying? And they went up to about 30 knots. What they would do is take two of us either by chopper or something, drop us in a canal, and we'd come down that canal. Then we got back. We'd do a chart of that canal, and that would let the 9th Infantry in their riverine boats know if they could go up there and do a landing or not. And that's one of the things we did. Of course, you only went down the river maybe once or twice, and you didn't go down it anymore. That was stupid.
Would you carry like a sidearm when you're on that little jet ski?
Yeah, we had a 45 in the front of the cover there, and that's what we had. We had a flak jacket on, a helmet, UDTs, and tied it with our feet.
Would you do it at night or in the daytime?
A daytime.
Oh, damn.
And then, you know, with that 350-degree camera across canals coming into pagodas, anything that was a known thing you could find on a map, we'd take a picture of as we went down. You tried to stay at the same speed all the way down, because otherwise your chart wouldn't be good, you know. But we only did that, and we couldn't do it too much. So, I mean, just the different rivers and different canals and stuff. So we got bored, so we started going out with the 9th Infantry on those river boats to be their demolition guys, blow up bunkers, and sometimes they'd put log dams across the river. We'd blow those up and stuff, and we took some heavies on that, doing that. So
what kind of situations did you get in when you're riding up with the 9th Infantry?
Well, we got caught in ambush one time. They usually had about five, six, seven boats. They had a boat in the front called an Alpha boat. It looked like your old monitor in the Civil War, and then they had like the landing craft. They had those with bar armor on the side, and then they had 50s up on top and back. They had that all built up, and they had bar armor so that if a B-40 rocket punched through, and they had real thick styrofoam so that it would just be channeled into one area if they hit them from the sides. Then they had 30s, two 30s on each side, each one of the landing craft type of boats that they put the troops in. And right in the middle of that was what they call a monitor. And you've seen that. That's over on Sism Field. Okay, that's a great big boat. Yep. And then at the back, they had another Alpha boat. And then all the ones in between.
So who was the – were those Navy boats or were they Army boats?
No, they're Navy. It was Navy guys doing it. I wouldn't have that job for anything in the world. No. Yeah. So anyway, we was going up, and a group had went up before us, dropped their people off, and they came right by us as soon as we got by them. They opened up on us, and it was a bad day. We had 30 killed and 70 wounded Americans, And like the Alpha boat ahead of us, everybody but one guy was killed on it. and that boat was floating by and still had the American flag flying. There's one guy on the back on that 30 still shooting.
Damn.
I mean, it was, you know, it still almost cracks me up when I, not cracks me up, it tears me up when I think about that. But it was just, that's the American fighting guy. You know, that's the way we are.
So,
and I'll give those riverboat guys all the credit in the world on those tango boats because they're just sitting targets, you know. And then after we got hit, of course, we all got, we were in the fourth boat back. And we heard number one boat's hit. That was the Alpha boat. Number two boat's hit. Number three boat's hit. We were number four boat. There were three of us UDT guys in that boat. And I remember looking over at a guy named going, we're fucked. Excuse me. I shouldn't have said it. Anyway, then we got hit, blew us all down and stuff. And one of my buddies had about 53 pieces wrapped on him. So I crawled over to him and hit him with morphine. Got up and the Navy guy got blown off his 30, you know, so I was shooting that until I ran out of rounds and shit. Well, the other guy, no, that was I got hit. The other guy saw all messed up, so he goes over and didn't see my pin through his collar, so he hits him with another shot of morphine. He lived, though. And then me and we got that, we just started shooting over the sides and stuff, and the Army guys wouldn't get up and shoot. They were handing us up weapons to shoot.
Well, sometimes
loading them and giving them to us, and we were up there hammering down, you know.
Sometimes you got a frogman up.
Yeah. Then the Cobras came in Army Cobras, and hosed everything down real good.
So were they doing like an actual landing? That's what the purpose was? And they were going to get a beach foothold and work an area for a while?
And work, make a sweep through there. And don't ask me why the Marines weren't doing it, why they had the 9th Infantry. I tell you why the Marines weren't doing it, was they were holding the DMZ up in north.
Yeah.
They said, the Marines, that's their job. But the 9th Infantry did a good job. They're good troops. You know what I mean?
Well, I know you haven't listened to this podcast much, but I know you have read the book that Leif and I wrote, and you know that I have nothing but the most utter highest respect for the Marines and the Army units that we work with. Were just phenomenal, and the sacrifices that they made and the bravery they showed on the battlefield was unbelievable on a daily basis. So I know it's definitely something.
You think about this now. Think of the training that we went through just for UDT to start with. And then I came back from UDT and went through SEAL team. So you get all the, what you guys call SQT. We called it CADRE back in the day. And then you go over again. You've already had your feet on the ground. Now you figure these Army guys go through basic training. And a lot of them head right over to Vietnam. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And they could be in Shaw Valley, anywhere, and where the crap really hit the brick. Can you imagine that? We had the training. We were volunteers. We volunteered for what we were going to do. Mm-hmm. We weren't just saying, here you go. We knew exactly where we were going to go, and we wanted to go. You know what I mean? So,
absolutely know what you mean. You know, another weird thing about Vietnam, and I've talked a lot about Vietnam, books from Vietnam, guys that were in Vietnam here, and, you know, the fact that these guys would rotate out, you'd be in the middle of a deployment. You just, you know, guys were just rotating out all the time. You know, it wasn't like what you just described, which you did in the SEAL teams and in UDT, and what we still do in the SEAL teams now is you get with your guys, you go through a workup with those guys together as a team, then you go on deployment together as a team, and you come home together as a team. And the Army guys, they would just, they're just filling in the holes, and the guy would go home, and another guy would take his place. So you never work with this, you know, you could have a guy on a patrol with you, two or three guys you never worked with before, and you're going out on patrol with them. So it's, I don't like that system. I like the way we do it.
Reminds me of Forrest Gump. You know, that was a pretty good little thing. You know,
what happened there?
The new guys that came into the platoon and, you know.
When he's checking in.
Yeah. Everybody's already been there already and they're just coming in. They hadn't worked up with these guys, nothing. They were just showing up, you know, and popping in.
We actually did take a couple guys in when I was in Ramadi. We took a couple guys that just showed up, new guys. And we just had to slowly, you know, put them on watch.
Well, did
for a while.
You have people that were taken out? That's why they came in.
Yeah, they were just guys that were filling in. We did. Oh, we lost guys, but they were just guys that.
Yeah.
They got sent to SEAL Team 3 from SQT, and when they got there, there's no one there, so they brought them over on deployment. A couple guys, it was like two or three guys, and we just, you know, okay, here's, we made them work in the compound for a while, and then maybe bring them out. They'd be a turret gunner on an op, and maybe eventually let them do a little bit more.
Work them in. Yeah, that's perfect. Yeah. That's what you should do it. So.
And so, any other
Vietnam
memories?
UDT stuff? Yeah. So another time we used to be on the front boat, the Alpha boat, because they were the first ones that saw the log dams or and had to blow up bunkers and shit. And we had about a big stack of C4 in the back, you know, the haversacks and shit, mm-hmm. you know. And all of a sudden the whole boat shook like this. We got a B-40 rocket right in one of the exhaust tubes, and we started sinking. So we... The coxswain ran it to shore and everything, and we were shooting back and everything, but the fucking boat was sinking. And if that had been about another 8 inches higher, it hit all that C4. You know? But we landed, and then we swam off and got out in the river in this other, they called it a Zippo boat. It was like the troop carrier boat, okay. but it was all napalm, or not napalm, whatever they got in flamethrowers, you know.
Oh, okay.
Flamethrower boat.
Okay.
And this thing just went... on the beach, you know, and we went and climbed up on that. We got out of there.
Dang.
Us and the crewman. That was another moment of excitement.
You know, it's just to go off of what you just said too, and with the training that you get in special operations, SEAL teams, whatever, Rangers, SF, is, you know, a lot of times we in special operations get a lot of praise for doing what we do, and that's great and everything. But like what you're talking about, being in a conventional unit, it's the same thing over in Iraq and Afghanistan. Being a conventional guy, that's no joke. I mean, it's in many cases, they're doing a much more dangerous job. I mean, even, you know, a logistics job, something like that, where they're exposing themselves on a regular basis. So anybody out there that's a civilian that thinks that the conventional guys aren't doing, you know, aren't taking as many risks as the special operations guys, I'm telling you right now, they absolutely are. They absolutely are. And, of course, there's things that that all special ops guys do that step it up as well. But everybody pays a price, and everybody takes a lot of risk when they go over there. And it sounds like it was the same thing when you had the 9th Infantry rolling up the river.
Yeah, damn. Those guys were good. They did their jobs. And if I seem to say anything derogatory, I apologize for
that. Oh,
it,
no, you didn't.
Those
you,
boys were
you didn't
good.
At all. Yeah. You didn't at all. I'm just pointing out. A lot of times, again, people – I'm sitting here thinking – I'm thinking exactly what you just said. Here you are, you're UDT, you've been through all this training, and you know, when that boat starts sinking, you're like, hey, I'm going to jump on the swim. There's regular Army guys there. They're thinking they haven't had the training that you've had, and yet they're still in the same, almost the same exact situation.
Exactly. So one other thing in UDT, we're doing a beach recon, and I was a cartographer, so I'm up in front with another guy, and I have this big, huge piece of plexiglass I'm doing all the backshore information on. But I'm ahead of them. We're putting in the stakes so the guys behind us can hit every 25 meters mm-hmm. and do their soundings and stuff. Well, we didn't. Usually we had ARVN, which are your South Vietnamese Army, right. or we had Marines that would do screening for us. You know, when we were doing the beach recons, we couldn't get either one of them. So we had two of our own guys doing it. So they were walking, going behind. It was all a lot of sand dunes and stuff like that on the beach, you know, and trees, little forests and stuff. Well, we almost walked right into this L-shaped ambush that they had set up for us, except the two guys back here, they had a spire hole back here so that when we fell back from the ambush, if any of us were still living, these guys would get us, right? Ugh. They hit these guys. So it made them open up, which made them open up earlier. Then we leapfrogged down and got out of there. But that was a few moments of excitement, too. And that's when I got back to the USS Dyshenko, and I went, you know, screw this naked warrior shit. Give me a 60 and carry me up and let me go out and hunt these guys at night. I don't like running down the beach in UDTs and, you know, my coral boots shooting an M79, keeping heads down and shit. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was a... But I was just UDT then, so I didn't talk too much about it, you know. I wasn't a SEAL.
So you get back from that deployment.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And every month when I was on that deployment, me and a guy named we'd put in a chip to go to SEAL team, and they'd just chew our asses out. You ain't going anywhere until we get back, you know. All right. So we'd wait a month and put another chip in. Well, when we got back, boom, we went right to cadre. I went and checked into SEAL Team 1 and went into cadre.
And the cadre training was what we call now STT, SQT, STT, SIT.
Yeah, all your IEDs, all that stuff. And actually, on the Alamo River and a few other places, they had it set up to be exactly like it would be in Vietnam with little watchtowers. And they had a whole village that was in amongst all the shit that's on the side of the Alamo River and stuff. It was really good training. Wow. Yeah. And then we'd do, they'd ambush us, we'd ambush them, they'd come down in, you know, sampans we had there and stuff like that. And just like on a, you know, when you do an ambush on a river, you always want to try to do it at a curve and hit them. So that way the sampans, after you hit them and stuff, will flow into the bank, not keep on going down the river and you can't get nothing out of them. Just all kinds of little tricks. And what they did, our cadre that ran us through the, our cadre instructors, were guys that had just gotten back, and they pulled them out of platoon to do that for about 6 months before they went back into another platoon. So we were getting continuous guys right out of the field in Vietnam, which is real good, and different areas too. The triple canopy shit, your mangrove stuff, and, you know, the rice paddies and all that stuff. Like,
where would you do a bulk of the training?
Oh, what? Out at an island.
Awesome.
And then we'd go up to Cuyamaca for map and compass and stuff. And then a bunch of us went through what they called SEAL Advanced Training, which is for your PRU program, which was 5 months long. And that was all tradecraft, medical, and stuff like that. And really, really good. Got really honed in more even on the IEDs and stuff like that. And booby trap trails, intel trails, all kinds of stuff. Yeah.
It's interesting as you talk about that, how much of that stuff, you know, carried on to you. When I showed up at SEAL Team 1, you know, we did booby trap trails. You know, there was no war. There hadn't been a war going on for 20 years when I got there, you know, in the Gulf War, but we still did booby trap trails. We did point man courses. We did the medical stuff. We did river ambushes. I mean, it's awesome that, and there was no, it wasn't really written down anywhere. That's,
and yeah,
like,
you should have had 2 weeks of advanced demo and kitchen table demo and stuff like that. Yeah, yep. Because we set all that up in SEAL Team 1. I know what you had. Should have still been going.
But that's awesome that it lasted that long, you know, with no, because the weird thing about SEAL Team is we didn't used to have anything written down. I mean, no. There was barely anything written down. And so all that knowledge was passed word of mouth from guy to guy to guy. And that's, I think we've corrected that now, where we capture more of the stuff.
Pretty much, yeah. But, you know, you ever want to fight Rangers? Get the Ranger Handbook.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's the only thing I had against that a little bit. It still should stay in-house. It should be rolled down, but you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I don't, you know, I can give you a Ranger Handbook, and you can find out exactly how those guys are going to fight, what their methods are, everything.
And another thing I've talked about on here is when you have doctrine, and you get tasked with something that's not in the doctrine, you get confused. You don't know what to do. Yeah. That's one of the reasons I think SEAL teams have been very successful in the recent past, and even in the longer past, is because we didn't have a book to look at. We had to figure out how to do it. And so no matter what the mission is, we always had a fresh look at it.
We adapt. We're unorthodox. We adapt. Right. I mean, you know, our guys, if you had pulled a platoon right out of Vietnam and put them in Ramadi or somewhere, we'd have been lost at sea because we didn't have the training for the urban type of warfare.
Yeah.
I
know you wouldn't have been lost at sea. I know you would have. Because the principles are the same. The same principles that you guys taught me was the same thing we did over there.
We'd have figured it
cover,
out.
Cover, move, take the high ground.
Yeah, we would have figured it out. But, you know, we didn't have overwatches and stuff like that when it's pitch dark at night and you're working your way through real quiet, not making a lot of noise.
Yeah.
Everything you do is for, you know, being silent. Or just like you guys never had to do things like if you hit a real taunt line, the point scout did, well, he'd step over it, grab the guy behind him, bring his hand down, show him where that wire was, and he'd step over the wire, he'd put his leg over it, grab the guy behind him, and that's how we got across until we got everybody across and got a head count, then we'd move on.
Damn.
That's just booby trap stuff. You know what I mean? And you did it and you couldn't see. It was pitch black. That's why you grabbed the guy's hand and showed him where it was. And if it's a tight one, you don't cut it. Mm. If it's all loose and stuff, then yeah, cut it.
So how would the point man see that?
Yeah, what they call it. We used, you take a twig, a long stick.
Oh, you put the
no string on it. But just like a fishing pole, and you'd run that up and down like that when we moved, and you'd feel it. You can feel it just like you would if you got a trout or a bite, and then you work your hand down, you reach over there and feel and see what that is. Yeah,
like a ninja.
Yeah. You know what the other interesting thing that when you started talking about SEAL Team and going out at nighttime and how that was all unorthodox and people weren't doing it is the opposite of when we were in Ramadi. We started going out in the daytime, And the reason we started going out in the day, there was a bunch of reasons why we started going out in the daytime, but one of the main reasons was the enemy knew that we owned the night. We had night vision. We had, you know, we owned the night. And so they didn't want to go out at night until they went out daytime. That's when they planted their IDs. That's when they killed people. That's what, and so we went out in the daytime because that's where the bad guys were out.
Well, you know, daytime in Vietnam, too, you'd see guys sleeping in hammocks and shit. We'd wrap them up because we knew they'd been out at night doing shit, so we wanted to talk to them. You know, just like rules of engagement and shit. When we got my last platoon, we stopped in Saigon and went to MAC-4V, and our LT got his orders, you know, and his orders were pacify the Vinh Long province.
Wow.
That was his orders, pacify the Vinh Long province. Roger that. And that's where we went off and did it, you know. No rules of engagement, nothing, just pacify it. And then it was like, okay.
Yeah. That's
and we didn't work for the Army, Navy, Marines, or anybody. We were our own entity. So if you'd been the OT over there, Jocko, you'd have had the con.
We would have had a good
matter
con.
Of fact, we were at Dong Tam. They had a naval base here, and then the big Army base here at Dong Tam. They had us stay on the Vietnamese Navy base in between them because the Navy didn't really want us on their base. Plus, their boats are right down there on the wharf, so it worked out perfect. You know what I mean? And we'd go to the Army to, you know, to test our weapons and shit like that. Yeah, and they were doing that all the time, so it wasn't like, you know what I mean? It wasn't anything unusual. You know what I mean?
So going back now, you get back from your first deployment with UDT. You go to the SEAL team. You show up. You're going through the training. What was the, you kind of talked to me a little bit about this before, but how were you getting treated? Because you got wounded on your first deployment as a UDT guy, right? Yeah. So here you are, you're a combat veteran, you've been in the shit, you've been wounded.
We called it a Viet Cong Achievement Medal.
So you show up at SEAL Team 1, you're kind of like, hey, I'm an experienced veteran, I've been through the shit.
And didn't mean shit.
And they just, the guys there, how'd they treat you?
Well, I mean, all right, just the same. I mean, I'd had a trip with UDT, but just about everybody that went into SEAL team came out of UDT, 11 or 12, into SEAL team. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Back in the day before they started bringing them right into SEAL team, the new guys, you know? So it wasn't any different. There were guys there. You just had to learn. I mean, I didn't, you know, when I was in UDT, I'll tell you, I wish I really wanted to go. Like when we were at Dong Tam, that was during the 67-68 Tet. And we got a call that the East Coast Platoon in Mito, which wasn't too far away from Dong Tam, was being overran. Luckily, they were up in a tall building, so they held out real good. They were the tallest building, and they had a 57 recoilless, and you could hear the VC coming up the stairways. They'd throw grenades down and shit like that. And they needed some help, and there were about 17 of us down on that dark patrol on the USS Benawa right by Dong Tam. And we begged our lieutenant, God damn, let us go in there. We'd have been fucking killed. Our heart was there, but we didn't have the IED training, immediate reaction. You know what I mean? None of that shit. I mean, we'd have been, it would have been stupid. So Oldish, our lieutenant, said no, and we hated him, you know. Then I got back and went to Cadre or SQT and did all that stuff and then deployed. Next time I saw John Odish, I hugged him. I said, you are one smart son of a bitch, dude. Our heart was there, you know what I mean. But UDT, you just weren't trained to operate on land. You didn't have the prerequisite skills that you learn in SQT and stuff, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you get more of that even in BUDS now than we ever got because we were trained to be a frogman. That was it. I mean, our last op we did at San Clemente Island was we swimmer scouted in by Birdshit Rock, and I can tell you this, you know what I'm talking about. They gave us 40 pounds of demo, haversack. We went 26 miles down to the other end of the island, blew up a target, then came 26 miles back and attacked the camp. Guys, as we were patrolling, they'd ambush us and they'd pick out guys that had been killed. Pretty soon we'd all fall down and they'd go, God damn it, we'll tell you who we shot. Then they'd get to go back to camp and defend it when we came back and attacked it. But it was still just a demo raid. You know what I mean? It wasn't anything patrolling, real good patrolling tactics and all that stuff that you learn. You know what I mean? I mean, like I went out with the Australian SAS in Nui Det and did a... a week out in the field. Oh, was it a week or was it 2 weeks?
Was this when you were at Team 1 or at
UDT? Yeah, Team 1. my second platoon, two of us, we had the Aussies come down and work with us, and they loved it. Then we went up to Nui Dip, me and the 60 guy, we went up and went out with them. We did a 10-day patrol with them, resupplying all that stuff. They never talked. Said one word. That whole patrol was all hand and arm signals.
That's awesome.
And they would get an LUP at night, everybody with their feet out, and you'd laying on your pack, have your weapon right next to you, pull what they call the silk gap, and you'd go to sleep. Well, me and didn't sleep for about two nights because that's when we usually went out and worked. Then we started to, because the way they figured it, it was in a real noisy area, and somebody in that circle would be awake. And if we got sprung or something, then you have 360-degree firepower, and we can get out of there. But they were the best I've ever seen. I've been to, I went to Army Ranger School, Raider Herp School, and everything. And that one 10-day patrol with the Australians, I learned more about reconnaissance than I did anywhere.
You know? Well, you know, we used to have guys from the SAS come to Team
yeah,
One.
Yeah, I know.
As a matter of fact. Yeah,
they did. We had that program for a long time, but there were, the last guy we had there was an officer, and he wasn't worth a shit. But some of the sergeants we had.
The guys that were there when I showed up were really squared away guys that definitely had their field craft down.
Oh, they're so good on field. That's what I was trying to say. Yeah. Field craft. Yeah. We did, in UDT, you just didn't have the field craft to be out in the jungle looking for people and shit. You know, that's why in UDT 13, some of the guys got killed and stuff, down trails and shit like that. They didn't, you know what I mean? Got to kind of have your shit together a little bit.
Yeah. So you go through the cadre training, you check into your platoon, and it's time to go on deployment. Where are you flying out of? Flying out of North Island?
Yeah, we fly out of North Island, and my first platoon, we flew into Cameron Bay and then took choppers down to a place called New Namcan, which is the very southern part of South Vietnam, right by a place they called the U Minh Forest.
And then did you do some turnover ops with the other platoons that were there? No turnover ops?
We didn't at that time. Matter of fact, most of our ops were dartboard ops. You ever heard of those?
No.
That's where you put a map behind you and you choose one of the guys in the platoon and you throw a dart behind you. Wherever that dart hits is where you're going to go into. Because we didn't have intel. We didn't have shit. We were pretty isolated. We were in a Vietnamese base camp in BF Egypt. You know what I mean? So that's how we went out.
Is there, what do you do in like a, doing helicopter insert or a river insert?
All riverine. And actually out of New Namcan where we were, we'd take sandpans out because we didn't even have any MST support or anything. The guys down at Seaflow did, which is a ways away from us. Mm-hmm. Our other squad was there. And finally they pulled us out of New Namcan because we were doing stuff, but it wasn't.
Wasn't effective.
It wasn't real that good. So they brought us down to Seaflow. Then we started getting some good ops down there.
And then what were those ops like?
We still did riverine ops. Like we went down to a place called Square Bay and because we heard there was a prisoner of war camp and stayed down there for about 3 days watching these trails, seeing if we could see them moving and stuff like that. We'd do ambushes. We'd get intel from our Navy Nilo, which still wasn't that good. Oh, one of the things in 69, that was first platoons in 69, was we landed at New Namcan, got our stuff off the old 46 that landed us there and put it in the bunker. And then this little loach came in and landed. Do you know?
No, I don't.
Yeah,
I don't.
He's a master
I know
chief.
His name, but
yeah,
I don't
he was
know
a,
him.
He was a Prue guy in that province that we were in down there. So he came in and told us, yeah, if you guys need anything, just let us know. And as soon as that loach left, we got mortared for about an hour and a half. So we told him never to come there again because they knew what that loach was.
Yeah.
He was a Prue, you know, and that was the Prue guys. You know? Now, he's a great guy. But, yeah, and he was a Prue down, long hair, you know, bearded, you know.
And so the platoon setup was, you had an OIC, an AOIC, a platoon chief, and an LPO, kind of like what you'd run, well, what we'd ran
we
in.
We had two squads, the LPO, and just like what you guys
just
did,
the
team
same
one.
Thing.
Exactly, yeah. And then we broke it down, you know what I mean? You had your, like, I was with the AOIC, and the last platoon I was in was my AOIC.
Really?
Yeah.
What year was that?
That was, when was that, 89?
Damn.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome.
But he was a...
That must have been fun.
Yeah, he was a great guy.
Awesome.
Yeah. But I'm just saying, he was the AOIC, was the OIC.
Roger that.
We had the LPO would work with him, and then I would, you know, have have the, you know, to kind of guide him. I was a senior chief then.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And I had I don't know if you knew any of those
guys. I know
guys.
All those guys, yeah. Yeah.
They're all in my platoon. It was my radio one. Worst radio one I ever had in my life, you know.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Oh, you know, I went to radio school like I told you, right? Yeah. Guess who never carried a radio on the team?
Really? You never carried a radio?
No, I was a 60 gunner.
Damn.
Until I made LPO, then I went to the M14. I like the 7.62 round.
Yeah, that's the that's kind of the standard. When I went through SQT, they told us if you're not carrying an M14, you're wrong.
Yeah. Oh, dead yeah. Wrong. That's a great weapon. It's accurate. It's perfect. I loved it. Yeah.
And guys, even a bunch of guys in Ramadi carried the M14 as well.
Yeah.
Because they're shooting, you know, you're shooting at vehicles, you're shooting through buildings, you're shooting, and they put the AP rounds in there, and just that way you've got some, you can dig through some stuff.
Yeah, we did 6 months deployment, and I did three deployments. I did 1969. I was in Kilo Platoon. And then came back from that. Then I actually got out for a year and a half because I was married. And my wife talked me into getting out. So I did. And worked for the phone company as a cable splicer. Hated everybody and everything. We lived in Coronado. So I'd go down the trade winds. And all my buddies would tell me what great trips they were having and stuff. And I just went, yeah.
What year was that?
That was, '70, '71. That was when I got back in '69.
So when you got back in 69, you got out for a year and a half.
Well, about a year, maybe not quite a year and a half, but I went back in and got in another platoon, luckily, and went to Vietnam again, 70, 71. And I had guys like that in that, but that was a great platoon.
And what was that? What was that? Now, were you an LPO that platoon?
No, I was still a second class.
You're a 60 gunner getting after it.
But, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And what was that? Was there any difference between that first SEAL deployment to Vietnam and the second SEAL?
Yeah, I wasn't
SEAL?
Real happy with the first deployment because we just didn't do a lot. I mean, it was okay. We did some stuff, but it wasn't my idea of what it should be, you know, as a SEAL. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah.
And then it was better when I got down to Sea Float, but it's still, you know what I mean? But that second platoon, that's the one that kept me in the Navy. You know, they were just, you know, we were a band of brothers. You know what I mean? We were so close, it was unbelievable. I mean, I love those guys.
And the difference in what you did, was it the missions that you got tasked with?
Yeah,
is it the way that the platoon commander kind of set things up so that he had a better vision of what to do and what to get after?
Absolutely. I was in my second platoon. That guy was just unbelievable. I mean, he was just really, really good. Our first platoon, it was... He was kind of nuts. We didn't like him. Like, one time we're all cleaning our weapons on Sea Float and everything, and what we used to do when we come back went up is grab a line, then you jump in the water and let it wash all the mud off you. Well, he grabbed the line and jumped in, and we had music real loud and cleaning our weapons and shit. Well, the line wasn't tied off, right? So he just started going down the river. But they saw him in the watchtower and said, man overboard, and went and got him.
You know, something that we talk about on here, and I've experienced is having blue on blue situations take place, and it's really hard for people to understand how it happens. But I know that you had one of those happen. You want to kind of give a quick debrief on that?
Yeah, we're about ready to go home. We had a new platoon come in. They wanted to do a break-in up, not mention any names of the officers, but they wanted to do a hammer and anvil up, which you just don't do with a brand new platoon. And we'd been there, you know, we had our stuff together pretty well in that area. But what it was we were supposed to push these bad guys, the VC, into these guys that were in a tree line. And they inserted us at the wrong place to start with. So when we started working our way in, we kind of came up to this tree line where it ended, a rice paddy, and then there was another tree line. I couldn't give you it was a halfway decent ways away, you know what I'm saying? But we had three Kit Carson scouts with us. Kit Carson scouts were North Vietnamese that had turned over to the South Vietnamese, and they put them in camps, and they called them Chu Hoi camps, basically. And what we would do is we'd go to these camps, And we would get these guys that knew our area that we're working in, and through an interpreter and stuff, we'd brief them and everything, and they'd come and work with us, and they'd work with us for on a couple of ops till they became kind of trusted agents. And they were pretty good. Most of them were not North Vietnamese, but VC that were good fighters, you know. And then they lived with us the whole nine yards. We paid them. We had money from NAV4B. They gave us a lot of money to pay these guys and stuff. So they weren't doing it just for free, you know, because they needed money for their families. And I don't know, the atrocities that happened to their families is one of the reasons they Chu Hoyed and came to to the South Vietnamese side. Anyway, we had three of those guys coming out in front of us, black pajamas, AK-47s, looked just like VC, you know. So the brand new platoon saw three guys coming out of the tree line that were VC, so they opened up on them, killed two of them and wounded the other one. We swung off to the left and laid down, and they were shooting 60s and stoners at us, but shit was just falling on their heads because they were shooting high, like new guys generally do before you. And there was pretty new, brand new guys in that platoon. You know, they weren't experienced and shit. Normally you'd walk them in, whatever, you know. So we're yelling the radio, cease fire, and we had our officer that was with us got up on his knees to shoot back at him and got shot through the heart. Then we finally got him to stop, and then we got him out of there. He was dead, though. He shot right through the heart. Yeah. That was a blue and blue thing. That was pretty bad.
And that was right before you went home?
Yeah.
Ugh. Yeah, the confusion that happens
out
there.
It was called a break-in op. You know, and like I say, the new platoon had about two guys, I think. Their LPO, I can't remember his name, and then was with me on that beach where we got shot. He was also in my training class. He was the either the OAC or AOAC on that. But most of the rest of them were all brand new guys. You know what I mean? Good training and everything, but, you know, this is their first, oh, goddamn, we're in a firefight. You know what I mean?
Yeah, anytime you get the opportunity to slowly work into the combat situations, you know, do a smaller patrol, do an easier patrol.
That's what we normally did.
Yeah.
But you not can't override your officers that you got, you know. Take them out in the daytime. That was a daytime op, by the way. But usually it's just to kind of get them oriented to the environment, what they're going to be in. And then we all had these, I don't know if we had one in 69, but 70, 71, we had these barn dance files. And every op we went on, we'd put a synopsis in this barn dance. So if you were going to go in that same area, you could pull out that barn dance file and read it and see what the guys had seen there, enemy, what the terrain was like, on and on. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It was pretty good, real good. And almost every platoon had those from previous platoons all the way up to you. So you can kind of get an idea of what you're going into if you didn't have intel on that area.
What are some of the leadership? You talked about your second platoon being super tight and super close. What were some of the leadership characteristics that you saw from the platoon chief and the platoon commander that as you look back, you recognize that those were really good traits that really brought everyone together?
Well, was our chief. He made senior chief, and he'd been over about three times. And it was just very easygoing, but very sharp. And he understood things really well. Our LPO was Gary Smith, Sheep Shit Smith. And he had been a PRU advisor in that province.
Oh, that's nice.
So as far as getting intel on all of our other sides, it was perfect. And then, I won't say much about him, but our LT, he was outstanding. He went on almost every op. In fact, one time, he'd burn his hand with a smoke grenade. We're still going to go out, and he was going to go out with us. He just had his hand wrapped up and shit, so he was over at the officers' club on the Navy side eating, and the officers are saying, well, your hand's all bandaged up and shit. You're still going out? He says, yeah, if they get by my guys, I'm dead anyway. But he was really good. He had his stuff together. He was just savvy, had his head on his shoulders, figured out things, quick thinker, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it was just innate. He was just good, you know?
And how about, I mean, you know, we always obviously hear now veterans get treated great now. I mean, from the Afghan War and the Iraq War, we get treated really great for the most part, by America and by the public. We get treated really well compared to what you guys had to deal with in Vietnam. Well, how much of that did you see when you'd come home? Was it, I mean, Coronado is a pretty pro-Navy town. I mean, in San Diego, it's a pretty pro-Navy town. Was it the same way back then? Was it relatively pro-Navy, or did you see some of the hippies and whatnot coming on?
They had some demonstrations sometimes, you know what I mean, like downtown San Diego, but not much. And we basically just hung out here in San Diego or to other bars that we knew. We'd fly out on North Island, fly into North Island. It wasn't like we were flying into San Francisco or something. So we didn't get hit with that real heavily, you know what I mean? And if we did have issues at a bar somewhere, we usually squirted away pretty quick, you know? So it wasn't really a problem. We didn't really, our guys here, the East Coast guys, I don't know, but our guys here, we didn't really have a thing. I'll tell you an op, though, in 69, we were going up this one canal, and we used to, PBRs couldn't get up it. So we had to take a Boston Whaler up it with a Twin 60s in the front, and one guy would sit and steer it, you know. We'd take a squad up there, maybe five guys, you know. And whatever squad didn't have the op tonight, they got to be the driver and the gunner, which I got to be the driver once, and I wasn't happy. I covered myself with flak jackets. I mean, who's anybody going to shoot at?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So we were going up real slow up this thing, and all kinds of filament lines and stuff like that that we were cutting ourselves through because it was low tide. Luckily, it wasn't high tide. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So we got up there and put the guys in, and we came back out, and the PBR said put their boats into a bank, right? So we're sitting there on the PBR, me and my buddy that was the gunner, another SEAL, and all of a sudden across this river, we heard this pop, 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 pop. It was a sandpan. So we're going to go after that sumbitch. But one guy driving, one guy in the 60, we needed a guy with that could see, too. You know what I mean? Because, you know, mm-hmm. So we asked one of the PBR guys, you know, who wants to go with us. And this whole time we'd been with him, that, God damn, we'd love to go out with you guys. The only guy on that boat that volunteered was the guy that was married.
Damn.
The rest of them wouldn't do it. So we jumped in the sandpan, one after the other one, hosed them down. They hit the bank, and then there was blood trails going into the, killed one of them. He was laying in the boat, and the other guy had gotten out and ran. And you could see blood spots, you know, falling in. Well, we didn't go after him. We're not that stupid, you know. Nighttime, you know, he's probably dying. Yeah, I'll take these guys out with me. So anyway, we brought the sandpan back, and goddamn, we had a whole big thing of intel and weapons and all kinds of shit. And the other guys, then we went up and got the other guys, brought them out. They didn't do a thing, you know. It's pretty neat.
That's sketchy.
Yeah.
I can't imagine that you guys would just go by these filament wires and step over these trip wires and just continue on your mission. That's sketchy.
You have to. That's what that's what we did. Anyway, so I wasn't on this op, but it was that, and a couple other guys from the other squad went down to Square Bay, and we'd gotten this intel that this sandpan, pretty good size one, almost like a junk, would go up the river at nighttime, up the main river where Seaflow was, up by that way, you know. So George and those guys were down there. They were, again, were in a Boston Whaler. They had a couple lob rockets with them and stuff like that, you know. So they figured, well, shit, we haven't really, it's been a dry hole here with that goddamn the junk when it comes by, you know. So they go out after the junk, and they could hear it and then see the silhouette of it, you know. So they got real close to it and fires a law rocket and hit the stern, not the exact rudder and everything, then popped a flare so they could shoot and everything. Well, after they popped their flare, about 15 other flares popped, and it wasn't there us.
Ugh.
So behind them was all this little flotilla of sandpans and shit. And so they took off and were shooting back with their Stoner and 60 and stuff like that. Finally, they called, and then a couple of PBRs came down and saved them. That was a pretty good op.
That's just so, that's one of the major differences, you know, with us having night vision now.
Yeah.
The whole way that you guys had to utilize illumination. And we did utilize illumination from time to time. We actually, on big operations, sometimes we'd have the army firing, or the army artillery would be firing illumination in certain situations. But generally, we weren't doing that.
Yeah, in ambushes, we always fired a flare up, you know, to get good vision. Yet where we had, then we got out of there. You know what I mean? put a claymores out, and claymores behind us. You know what I mean? Everything sat waiting for dudes to come down the river, and then we'd hit them, you know.
And then, so you get back from your second tour in Vietnam, and is that the war ended, right? I mean, this is
pretty much
that was it.
In fact, the platoon that was at Ben Luck, which was 40 miles away from us, they were only over there for 3 months, and they came back too. So we were the last full deployed platoon in Vietnam. Yeah. That was November platoon. Was our chief, like you said, just a bunch of great guys in the platoon.
And I mean, at that time, there was a couple hundred guys at SEAL Team 1?
I think there was about, maybe it had boosted up real high, so there might have been 250. 300. Mm-hmm. I think there was only about 150 when I got in there. I don't know if the big push had started yet to build more guys up. There wasn't a lot. You knew everybody. I mean, it was a pretty tight group.
And one guy that we both know, he told me when he checked into SEAL Team 1 back then, he was like taking a shower after PT, and like every guy was shot up. Like you could just see every guy was, you know, you could see scars in their arm, leg, wounded. Did you? Were a lot of guys staying in at that time, or a lot of guys doing a couple platoons getting out?
I think most of the guys stayed in. That's what we did. That's what we loved. And then after the war, yeah, we had a pretty good exodus of people getting out.
And were they getting out because
there was nothing to do? Yeah, that's what they were doing. That was their, you know, there's nothing else. I mean, what are you going to do, you know? And I stayed in because I just liked the guys. I liked what we did, you know, and like when I was over at Bud's, I come back in 70-71, and then I went over to Bud's as an instructor, and I got bored doing that. So there's this guy called...
I'll tell you, I would not want to be a student when you are bored as a Bud's instructor.
I was a nice guy there. But anyway, so when Buddy Dahl was in UDT, he's a little bitty guy from Colorado, and he was a rodeo rider, right? So he talks me into going out this place called Burton's, which is out by, it wasn't Lakeside, it was Lemon Valley.
Mm-hmm.
Or
Lemon Grove?
Lemon Grove, yeah. Mm-hmm. And there was a place called Burton's out there, and it was just all bulls, but they were dinks. They weren't real, your rodeo bulls, you know. So I went out there, and hell, I liked it. And never got bucked off there, so I went rodeo and went IRA, then PRCA.
No kidding.
And actually thought about getting out of the Navy to ride rodeo, because I loved it. But then I got bored because rodeos, bulls, I rode bulls. They were the last of the event, right?
Yeah.
So I started riding bareback and saddle bronc too. But the I got stepped on. Well, I got 22 stitches in my left side of my face, 14 in the back of my head, had both my shoulders dislocated. What else? Got gored, and then I got stepped on and had 5 busted ribs and punctured lungs. So I figured, okay, that's enough. So I quit doing that and just stayed in the teams, you know.
The teams are safer than rodeo riding. Yeah,
well, that was over a year and a half, almost 2 years, so yeah. It wasn't bad.
Yeah, and what about guys? I mean, how were guys doing as far as handling what they'd seen and coming back, and all of a sudden they're in Main Street?
Dude. We didn't have that problem. Yeah. I mean, I'm telling you, the guys that were crazy before they went over.
I often say that.
They weren't, I mean, I know all my buddies. In fact, this Thursday night, we'll have that UDT, Vietnam UDT SEAL get together on Thursday night. Talk to those guys. You don't see anybody going, you know, I've got to go to the hospital, I'm mentally ill. And not that I know of, I tell you. Maybe it did happen, but the only guy I know that really got affected was he was with that one platoon, I can't think of the name of it, and they were taking apart a mortar, and the mortar blew up. And he had just left to have a cigarette, and all of his buddies got killed by that mortar and stuff, including a guy named who was just a superb guy. And he wasn't quite the same after that, and I can understand that. I mean, that, you know what I mean? But just being the firefights and shit like that and stuff that happened, nobody, you know, we just, it was the way it was, you know?
And even when you got out for the first, so then you did 30 years in the Navy. And, you know, that was another funny thing. When I talked about earlier, when you graded you lane graded me for the first time, I don't know how old you were. It was 1993, maybe?
What platoon were you in?
I was in, Alpha Tune at Team One with.
Yeah, was a good off.
Yeah, yeah, but you were. I don't know how old you were in that time period, but you know, from my perspective, you were like 170 years old,
oh, yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And I'm thinking to myself, hey, this guy's, you know, this is Roger Hayden, and you're like putting on your wetsuit. Oh, okay, put on the wetsuit. I guess he's going to get in the water. Gets in the water, swim in, do the recon.
I swam in with him, did the recon, and then he swam back out.
Swam back out, you know. Yeah, that was.
That's what you have to do. If you're going to do OREs, you got to do them right. You know, go point A to point B. Otherwise, you don't see everything, you know. And that's what I liked. I was a warrant then, but that's what I liked my last 3 or 4 years, I think, in the teams as I did ORE. Mm-hmm. So you still got to have your feet on the ground with the boys, you know. You couldn't be in a platoon, which sucked, but that's the way it was. You know?
Yeah, there's nothing better than the platoon life. Now, I know that you're short on time, and I rushed this, and I'm glad we were able to get a little bit done. And I think maybe after this one, and we get to listen to it, and I'll probably end up with a bunch more questions. I know people that are listening to this, a bunch of team guys listen to this. They actually, a bunch of team guys sent me a bunch of questions. I didn't get to any of them.
Yeah, we will. Yeah, I know. I'm sorry. And
no, it's all good.
It's just things that pop up in your head when you talk about them. You know, I mean, there's a lot of, I was a frogman first and then a SEAL, you know. That was probably one of the best deployments I ever had. That was great. And Philippines is great, and we were so glad to leave the Philippines and go back to a death just to get out of for a while. We would have died, you know.
So we'll definitely get you back on here, and like I said, next time I'll get some questions from the team guys that they asked me to ask you and go through some of those. But man, thanks for coming on. I know, like I said, I know you've never been out in the public eye before, and that's just the epitome of a quiet professional that we were all raised on, and I appreciate it. Like I said, you're a hero of mine, you're a hero of the SEAL teams, and you're really a hero to everybody in this country. And if anybody out there wants to continue this conversation, you can get Echo Charles and I on the social media. Echo is at Echo Charles. I am at Jocko Willink. We're on all the different social media, Twitter, Instagram, and the Facebook. If you want to support the podcast, Echo Charles, how can they do it?
If you want some supplements, the Kind Network, obviously, Onnit has the best ones. So you go to onnit.com/Jocko, you get 10% off. Boom. That's one way. Also, before you do your Amazon shopping, of course, go to one of the websites, right? Jocko Store or JockoPodcast.com. Click through the Amazon link there before you do your shopping. Or to make that part easier, we have the Trooper tool. It's just this little extension thing you can put on your browser. You get that on any of the websites as well. You just click on it. It's called the Jocko Store Trooper tool Chrome extension. Just click on that, confirm it's on there. It'll automatically do it for you, so you don't have to remember. It's good. Also, if you like the shirts that we have, boom, that's the one. Discipline Equals Freedom is a good one. But yeah, get some of those. That's how you can support.
Awesome. And you can get the book that Leif Babin and I wrote that actually Roger did the security clearance on.
I just reviewed it for the FOIA thing, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
No big thing. But one thing I will say, you know, and I don't think I'm a hero. I just went over and did my job, had a lot of fun, and was with the great guys. You know, that's about it.
Well, that's one of the things that makes you a hero. And thanks for coming on the show. And also, if you don't know, we're having a little conference out here in San Diego, California, October 20th and 21st. Is not going to be for everybody, but if you want to get in the game, if you want to do something that's going to be intense, to focus, we're going to talk about leadership, we're going to talk about getting better at what we do, come on out. The Muster, October 20th and 21st. Roger, thanks again for coming on the show. Thanks for everything you did serving this country in Vietnam and spending the rest of your life supporting the SEAL teams dedicated to our country. And like I said, Roger is kind of an unknown veteran. And I would like to take a moment to thank all the Vietnam veterans that fought with courage and with honor in a hard war, in an unpopular war, and not only fought for freedom against the evils of communism, but also established and passed on lessons learned for the current generation of warfighters. We owe all of you a great debt of gratitude for what you did for us and for the United States of America. And everyone else out there, thanks for listening. Thanks for spreading the word. And as you go through life, remember the sacrifice of these veterans that fought and sacrificed for us so that we can live with the sacred freedom to go out into the world and get after it. So until next time, this is Echo and Jocko and this true hero, Warrant Officer, Chief Warrant Officer, SEAL, retired, Roger Hayden.